also expect lawyers from Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon to join in as well.
And an optimistic Gilles de Verre, who has already filed a complaint of genocide against Israel with the International Criminal Court, demanding an arrest warrant for top Israeli politicians, including Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
This is going to be a tough battle, without a doubt. But in just a few months, all these lawyers have joined us. This kind of solidarity is unprecedented. We have never seen so many lawyers join hands for one purpose in history. So this is a great sign, because it won't be enough to tell a judge, look, there's no many of us. Instead, we have to be able to defend Palestine with strong legal arguments. And by the looks of things, we have a solid base for that.
His South African fellow companion shedding light on the legal aspects of the matter while explaining how the case brought to the International Court of Justice by South Africa is also paving the way.
The ICJ order specifically spoke about creating a humanitarian corridor and a humanitarian assistance to the people of Gaza. The United States and Israel were saying that the word ceasefire did not exist in the ICJ order. But this is not true, because the humanitarian aid on the ground at scale cannot be delivered without an effective and immediate ceasefire.
It is very clear that we are witnessing a birth of new age. A new movement of justice-seeking people from all over the world is emerging, and that is why, while the South African government files a complaint, we see a grassroots movement also taking shape. A very unique one that has brought together lawyers who are seeking justice in the battle between good and evil.
And in the words of these legal experts, this goal is not far from reach.
Lawyers believe that we live in a new era in which this new global initiative will eventually lead to justice for Palestinians. Gisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
An annual meeting of Quran reciters and memorizers with the leader of the Islamic Revolution.
Every year on the first day of the holy month of Ramadan, leader of the Islamic Revolution receives top reciters of the Holy Quran to stress the importance of this very holy book in the lives of Muslims.
In the meeting, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei described the recitation of the Quran as a sacred art, while underlining that the primary objective of this very valuable skill should be to convey the meaning and message of the Quran to the public and society and create the ground for contemplation of the Holy Scripture. Elsewhere in his speech, Ayatollah Khamenei expressed his satisfaction with the abundant number of young Quran reciters in the country, viewing their increase as a blessing of the Islamic Revolution. Meanwhile, referring to the crimes committed by the Zionist regime in Gaza, the leader pointed out that the peak of resilience that is being witnessed in Gaza presently stems from a profound familiarity with and adherence to the teachings of the Quran. Before the meeting, young and experienced reciters and memorizers were very much excited to listen and take a glimpse of the leader.
I am very much excited to recite some verses of the Holy Quran in the presence of the leader. But this is a great opportunity for me to see the leader.
This is the third time I have the honor of attending such a great event. Today I am going to have supplications to recite about the holy month of Ramadan.
Other reciters were worried about the people of Gaza, who are observing the holy month of Ramadan amid the Israeli bombing and shelling campaign.
The month of Ramadan is the month of mercy and blessing. I do believe that during this month, the Zionist regime will face a big defeat.
At the end of the ceremony, the Quran reciters and memorizers held congregational prayers led by the leader of the Islamic Revolution and broke their fast together. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Iran, Russia, and China have conducted the main phase of a joint naval drill dubbed Maritime Security Belt 2024. After arriving at the northern part of the Indian Ocean, the vessels of the three countries practiced different operations. The joint drills took place in 17,000 square kilometers of water in a region that is an internationally crucial hub for energy and trade traffic.
The first phase of the naval drills included live firing at designated surface targets in the Sea of Oman. Various vessels and fast attack crafts from the IRGC were also involved in the exercise. The vessels were armed with the state-of-the-art homegrown advanced weapons. The next phase included the Photo X exercise and offensive formations. The helicopters of the Islamic Republic of Iran Navy and the IRGC monitored the region in all stages of the exercise. Iran's Navy commander hailed the exercise as a successful endeavor to improve maritime cooperation of the contributing countries. The commander also said that Iran expects the drills to expand in the future.
This year, as we expected, regarding the types of vessels participating in the exercise, both China and Russia have increased the variety as well as tonnage of the vessels. So hopefully, we expect more countries to join the drills in the future, especially regional states.
Admiral Irani also stated that regional nations have the capacity to confront piracy and terrorism by enhancing cooperation. The exercises are the latest in joint drills by Iran, China, and Russia. Iran says regional countries are most welcome to take part in the drills that are going to take place in the future. The Islamic Republic has time and again stressed that regional countries are the ones that are truly in charge of establishing security in the region. Mahdi Abbasian, Konarak.
On the first day of the holy month of Ramadan in Nigeria, the Islamic movement held a rally through the streets of the capital, Abuja, in a peaceful protest against the massacre of innocent civilians in Gaza. The protest march took the demonstrators to the gate of the United States Embassy, where they sat down and submitted a letter of protest condemning the Israeli genocide in Gaza and U.S. involvement in the killing of innocent Palestinians.
America is one of the major party in this killing of innocent female and children in Gaza. Since October 7th to date, they have killed 31,000, more than 31,000 innocent people, majorly female and children in Gaza.
The demonstrators blame the United States and British governments for using their influence to block a UN resolution calling for a ceasefire. They said every decent government has condemned the Israeli terror attacks on the Palestinians, but the US government has continued to support the mass murder of innocent Palestinians.
They are killing female and children. They are imposing starvation on innocent female and children. Babies have been seen under rubble, crying inside blood. We see a lot of fathers carrying a lifeless body of their children killed by Israelis. Anybody that has concern for humanity should come out today on the street and show his solidarity with Palestinians.
The demonstrators burned the U.S. and Israeli flags as they slammed Tel Aviv's regime impunity and the silence of the international community. Many Muslims in Nigeria believe that Israel's continuous killing of Palestinians in Gaza on the eve of the holy month of Ramadan is a clear proof of the regime's disrespect for Islamic sanctities. The protesters here are urging world leaders to pressure Israel to end the massacre in Gaza. Anjum Abdullahi, Abuja.
Britons treat their National Health Service, better known as the NHS, with an almost religious reverence.
We grow up using the NHS from the cradle to the grave, free of a point of use, and that has tremendous significance for our lives.
But today, this eternal source of national pride is under increased scrutiny, with new figures showing more than 120,000 people died last year in England alone from delays in life-saving treatment. The NHS is a state-funded healthcare system founded in 1948. Back then, it cost around $20 billion in today's money to run. Last year, the government spent more than $181 billion. Despite that, more than 7 million people are now on the waiting list in England alone. That's nearly 12% of the population having to wait at least 52 weeks for a health consultation.
Our politicians aren't really serving the public interest. They are serving a neoliberal agenda, which is to transfer the country's natural assets and wealth to overseas corporations like United Health of America and other big multinationals.
The government has promised to cut the long queues, but has made little progress. The situation is no better in the rest of the kingdom. In Scotland and Northern Ireland, 1 in 80 people, and in Wales, 1 in 20 are having to wait more than a year for treatment. There's also the energy costs and inflation that has reduced the value of the NHS budget, meaning it now has to do more with significantly less. Add to the mix a shortage of staff, which means more pressure on exhausted employees.
We've had more than a decade of defunding since the financial crash. This has led to a real terms wage cut for staff. The whole population, the health needs have gone up. We have trouble keeping hold of staff. And we've also lost significant capacity with the NHS through privatisation. So we don't have enough beds, we don't have enough staff, and the staff we do have are being treated appallingly.
The health service is also coping with an ageing population. A large number of people now live with chronic conditions like heart disease and diabetes.
The COVID-19 pandemic severely tested the NHS, with its aftermath still posing serious challenges. Health officials and experts warn for the UK's National Health Service to survive, the next government should declare it a national emergency. Saipur is up, London.
India says it will enact the Citizenship Amendment Act that provides fast-track naturalization for multiple religious groups who fled to India from Afghanistan, Bangladesh and Pakistan before 2014. The law, however, excludes Muslims from those countries. Back in 2019, law's approval sparked deadly protests across the country and was halted since. The Muslim minority in India fears the government is using this law and other similar laws to widen crackdown on them.
India introduced this bill in 2016. With the aim of granting citizenship to what it calls a persecuted section of refugees. However, the bill has become one of the most controversial issues across the country since it excludes Muslims from availing citizenship. Critics accuse the ruling BJP of targeting a particular community on the basis of faith, which experts call unconstitutional.
Commentators also question the exclusion of persecuted religious minorities from other regions such as Tibet, Sri Lanka and Myanmar. India's Interior Ministry has said in a statement those eligible can now apply online for Indian citizenship. The issue has been one of the key pledges of Indian Prime Minister since assuming office in 2014. The new legislation makes changes to more than six decades old Indian citizenship law.
It's unfortunate for us that we are not part of this new law, despite the fact we have faced worse persecution any community has faced so far. We have still hope one day India will accept us on the ground of humanity.
Opposition political parties have accused the ruling party of influencing the elections, saying the move is to polarize the voters, considering its timing. More than 200 petitions challenging the law are still pending before the court of law.
We thank India they provide us shelter. It's an act of kindness, but we urge this country not to abandon us, knowing the fact we have seen deadly violence and persecution.
India, home to roughly 200 million Muslims, have recently seen targeted attacks and vicious hate campaigns. Critics accuse the ruling party of mixing religion with politics, resonating with India's majority. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Russia Navy warship, and China Navy warship. This is Iranian Navy warship 235. I call you on channel 16. Do you read me? Over.
the Maritime Security Belt 2024 has officially kicked off with Russian and Chinese vessels entering Iran's territorial waters south of the country on Tuesday. The naval and airborne units of Iran's army and the IRGC, along with their Chinese and Russian counterparts, will participate in various operations during this exercise. Naval delegations from Azerbaijan, Pakistan, Kazakhstan, Oman, and South Africa have also taken part as observer states. At the first stage of the drill, the naval officers of the three countries as well as the observer states reviewed different phases of the exercise on maps and held tactical briefings. Later, the naval commanders of Iran, Russia, and China held a joint presser. The Iranian Navy's deputy commander said the main aim of the joint exercise is to help safeguard security in the northern part of the Indian Ocean.
Upholding peace and security in the north of Indian Ocean and having a specialized cooperation in combating piracy and terrorism in our region are among the main goals of this exercise. We are constantly working to improve this cooperation.
Meanwhile, Chinese and Russian Navy commanders said the joint exercise further demonstrates the preparedness of the participating countries to maintain security while also deepening their practical cooperation. 2024 is the fifth consecutive year that the Islamic Republic of Iran's Navy is hosting countries participating in the Maritime Security Belt drills in the northern Indian Ocean region. This year's naval drills have kicked off under the motto Together for Peace and Security, with participating countries highlighting the importance of jointly safeguarding regional security. Mahdi Abbasian, Konarak.
This is not the first time Palestinian people are spending Ramadan under Israeli aggression. In 2014, the Israeli regime also waged a destructive war on Gaza during the holy month. However, the current genocidal war is unprecedented in terms of its colossal casualties. Many Palestinians have become orphans and widows and lost their children. The memory of their loved ones will stay with them in Ramadan.
The life here is so difficult. The holy month of Ramadan is around the corner and we are still displaced from our homes and our families are torn apart. We have nothing to eat for iftar. I'm originally from Gaza. I've lost 37 members of my family. They were so close to my heart. Every time I remember them, my gut is wrenched and I become so sad and furious.
With markets destroyed and goods scarce, Gazans don't know where their iftar meals will come from, which means more suffering and agony. The vast majority of the people live in small tents amid the starvation that has already claimed the lives of several Palestinian children.
The situation in Gaza is very difficult. There is no food. The people are struggling to find anything to eat with flour scarce. Here in the south, they queue in long lines for food. Even those who attempt to get anything from the aid trucks are putting their lives at risk as Israeli soldiers open fire on them. I don't know what we're going to do in Ramadan.
Palestinians' catastrophe doesn't stop with the loss of their relatives. It is deepened by the full-scale destruction that has become palpable in every corner of Gaza, including mosques, which means they won't be able to say their prayers and worships as usual. Even if their mosques hadn't been destroyed, it would still be impossible for them to perform their prayers under the incessant Israeli bombardments.
The humanitarian conditions are completely disastrous. The people were displaced from several parts of Gaza, including the northern and central areas of the Strip. It is literally catastrophic. There is no source of income or food, and the people are completely relying on the small amounts of donation provided by limited numbers of charity institutions. In addition to that, mosques have been completely destroyed by Israeli warplanes and we will never be able to pray in them.
While some aid has been trickling into Gaza, it's minuscule compared to the needs of the Palestinians. With Ramadan arriving, more assistance cannot come soon enough for them.
As the whole Muslim nation welcomes Ramadan, Palestinians are wondering why they have been abandoned by many Muslim leaders to face the Israeli campaign of death and starvation. To Abu Musabbih, the central area of Gaza Strip.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary. O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely Thou art the All-Forgiving, the All-Compassionate.
This one lay.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. Israel's genocidal war on the Gaza Strip continues with unflinching support from the U.S. Massive aerial and artillery strikes keep pounding neighborhoods, homes, refugee camps, while civilians trying to receive aid have turned into new targets for Israeli forces. Hamas resistance movement has presented a new ceasefire proposal, but the warmongers in the Israeli cabinet have once again rejected the idea of peace by approving a plan for a ground invasion of Rafah in the southern Gaza Strip. Now, what is left of the credibility of international bodies like the UN, which have been unable to put an end to what is believed to be the most tragic chapter of modern history unfolding before our very eyes in the besieged Gaza Strip? Our guests for tonight's Spotlight are journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier, joining us from Brussels. And we also have attorney, activist, and political analyst Zakir Ahmad Maia, joining us from Johannesburg.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Magni in Brussels. Israel's prime minister, as we just mentioned, has rejected a new ceasefire proposal by the Hamas resistance movement that included the release of the regime's captives in exchange for the release of Palestinian abductees. Give us your overall views on these talks. Is Netanyahu, in your opinion, a main obstacle to any ceasefire agreement, as it may mean the end of his political career?
Thank you for having me. Indeed, Benjamin Netanyahu is the main obstacle with his government, of course, because he is confronted with a coalition of ministers of the far right wing, like the security minister Ben-Gvir and the finance minister Smotrich, who threatened him to pull out of the coalition and resign if he stops the war. On the other hand, he is confronted with the small war cabinet, Benny Gantz and Gabi Eisenkot, who are telling him that the priority should go to release the prisoners and to accept an exchange of prisoners with the Palestinian resistance. Of course, the Israeli society is made of warmongers. They all agree on continuing the war. However, we see as a very significant failure of the Israeli occupation forces in Gaza, in the north, in the middle, in the south, in Khan Yunis, in Hamad City. They go back to Beit Hanun in the north. They go back to Ashat again on the west. And they're not managing because the Palestinian resistance is harassing and killing the Israeli officers and soldiers. And that comes from the defense minister, Yoav Gallant, who confessed that they are paying a heavy price. So how he's going to go and conduct further operation in Rafah instead of sitting around the table and negotiate a ceasefire if he is not managing to occupy and control Gaza. This is the dilemma he's facing, but because of the support of the society for the war, he is finding strength in comparison to the pressure that he is subjected to by the Americans, by the Europeans, by the Congress, by the American administration, and by the population around the world. So for him, it's a decision either to step down and resign and accept his failure, or to continue the war without achieving any strategic objective.
Mr. Ahmad Mayed, Israel is bombing areas of Gaza that it had designated as being safe, wiping out entire families. And now, in a recent statement from the Israeli Prime Minister's office, Netanyahu has apparently approved plans for the military operation in Rafah. That's the southern Gaza city where more than a million people are sheltering. How far will this clear intent to destroy Gaza continue as the world looks on?
I think with the blanket support of the United States, even at the expense of Joe Biden's election campaign and the possibility of him not being re-elected for his unconditional support for the genocidal state of Israel, the Israeli administration will continue to massacre the Palestinian people. The only reason why there's been a dragging of the feet, so to say, with regards to the operation in Rafah was because of two things. One, it required planning, and more importantly, they were very concerned about what would happen during Ramadan. The major concern for the Israeli military establishment was the West Bank and the Arab population within Israel proper. The statements by Netanyahu, the statements by Itamar Ben-Gvir, the statements by Bezalel Smotrich were inflammatory, and they were extremely concerned about a flare-up within the Palestinian territories as well as within the Arab populations within Israel proper. And now that we have crossed into the holy month of Ramadan, Israel believes that they have no other options and they cannot continue to delay indefinitely, and they have to move on Rafah. Rafah has been pinned as the key to the success of Israel. We all know that Israel has not succeeded in any of its domains. We see continuous attacks in Gaza City. There's fighting, severe fighting in Khan Yunis. There was even attacks in Beit Hanun, and Beit Hanun was one of the first areas that saw conflict when Israel invaded on the ground invasion. So Israel has no dominance on the ground. It is losing its air superiority as well. We're consistently hearing of anti-aircraft weaponry being fired as well as drones being captured by the resistance. And the move on Rafah is merely to extend Netanyahu's political life. And that is why he's also jostling for a fight within the north. And Hezbollah has responded quite heavily with regards to that. And I think that we might be heading for an escalation if Israel continues on this trajectory.
Mr. Magni, global condemnations have been pouring in over Israel's massacre of over 100 Palestinians who were waiting for humanitarian aid in Gaza City on Thursday. Israel has made a habit now of slaughtering those seeking aid in Gaza over the past several weeks. Now, impeding aid and starving Gazans is one part of the collective punishment, but murdering in cold blood people seeking aid, that definitely fits in the bracket of genocide, doesn't it?
It does indeed. Not only that, it's a crime against humanity, war crimes, and should be brought in front of the International Criminal Court, not the International Court of Justice. Secondly, it is the Israeli occupation forces are demonstrating that their strength is only manifested in killing civilians, in targeting women and children, and in starving the population in Gaza to put pressure on the Palestinian resistance because they are failing to confront the Palestinian resistance. However, the world condemnation really reached to no conclusion, really, and nothing concrete, because we cannot accept that the Americans are condemning the killing of more than 30,000 civilians in Gaza, acknowledging it for the first time by Joe Biden himself, and then insisting on sending weapons to the Israelis to continue killing the Palestinians. Secondly, to say that Israel has a right to defend itself, even yesterday by the White House, it's a total mockery because Israel is not defending itself. Israel is killing civilians and starving the population in Gaza. So the multiple ethnic cleansing by pushing more than 700,000 Palestinians from the north to the south, and then from the south to Rafah, and displacing them to non-secure area as an occupation force is again an ethnic cleansing that Israel is responsible of. Now, the mere fact that the International Court of Justice accepted the case of intent genocide is because there is a strong ground for it. And we have heard how the deliberation of all the lawyers in this case, and we're all quoting the United Nations resolution. Now, the United Nations is calling for the cessation of the ceasefire and for the murdering of the civilians. But Israel seems giving no attention to any country around the world and asking the world not to lecture the Israelis for their doing, promoting the killing of children because they will be the fighter that they will fight them in the future, promoting the killing of women that they will be pregnant and carrying the children who are going to fight Israel. So you can't have more criminal mind than the Israeli mind.
Mr. Ahmad Mayet, the U.S., it wants to establish a port to deliver humanitarian assistance in Gaza, but at the same time, it provides weapons and lethal arsenal to the Israelis. Please break down this appalling hypocrisy by the U.S. Mr. Mohammed Al-Hindi, he's the Deputy Secretary General of the Islamic Jihad Movement, which we spoke to earlier here on Press TV. He called this as an act of sheer hypocrisy, and that the U.S. is attempting to mislead the international conscience and buying time for Israel. Do you see it in that light as well?
Most definitely. There's no other interpretation with regards to this. If we look at the plan to establish the port of the coast of Gaza, this is an Israeli plan. There are numerous entrance points into Gaza which Israel controls, and Israel had been instructed by the ICJ to ensure that humanitarian aid entered into Gaza. The problem that is present before us is not one of allowing aid in. It's a political problem within Israel. And this was not admitted in other publications, but was admitted in the INSS annual conference. This happened about a week ago, where they indicated that there's a split within the government. The war cabinet allows for the humanitarian aid to go in. Then you have the extreme right-wing individuals, we've already mentioned their names, starting to produce opposition to that and organizing protesters to prevent trucks from going in. So what do? They move to this concept of dropping humanitarian aid by airdrops. Most of the aid that we have seen has forced Palestinians to fight over the aid, having to go down the path of survival of the fittest. This has another political function and also a military function because they're trying to bypass UNRWA. If we look at the statements in a recent interview given by Major General Uzi Dayan, Reserve Uzi Dayan, he said that they need to destroy UNRWA because of the refugee issue. And one simple way to do that is to take away the distribution of humanitarian aid as a function of this organization. That is also one of the primary issues with regards to the support. So when we look at what is happening, it's no act of benevolence on the part of the United States, Israel, or any other country that has participated in this. It is part and parcel of a plan to try and establish Israel as the supreme power within the region, within Gaza, and to ensure that Hamas and UNRWA is destroyed. This is the weaponization of humanitarian aid. If they wanted to allow humanitarian aid in, it's very simple. Allow the streamlining of the checks, allow for the trucks to get in, and the handful of protesters should be moved away from the borders by Israel. It's as simple as that. These are all machinations to push an agenda, and it's simply the principle of war, negotiate while advancing. That's exactly what they are doing right now.
Elijah Magni, in an exclusive interview that we had with the deputy leader of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement, we discussed the Palestinian resistance in Gaza. Mr. Mohammed Al-Hindi said the resistance is carrying out operations in areas which Israel actually claims to have captured, including in the north of the Strip and also in Khan Yunis to the south. Now, after over 5 months of lethal and deadly attacks, the resistance groups are fighting back strong both inside and outside of Gaza. This is surely a serious failure for the Israeli murdering machine, especially in the eyes of the Israeli public.
The 7th of October and 5 months after that date, it is now pretty obvious of the capability of the Israeli army, to the point that many American generals are mocking the Israeli army and the time they are taking for trying to occupy 364 square kilometers in Gaza. So we see the Israeli army since 29th of October last year saying we have control of the north. And then we hear just a few days ago that the Israeli army is bombarding Beit Lahia in the north, and then they're pushing the army into Beit Hanun, and then they conducting operation in the north, and then they say we are attacking Khan Yunis, we're destroying the Palestinian resistance, but then today they pulled out of Hamad City, west of Khan Yunis, and then they return to it, and then they pull out, and they're struggling all the time because they are facing people, resistance, owner of the land, who are determined to offer their life to defeat the oppressor and this occupation force. And they're not managing because they are not the owner of the land. The only thing they are trying to do is to kill as many civilians as possible, among these the families of the fighters and the resistance, so they can demoralize the resistance. But it's not working, because at the end of the day, during the negotiation of the ceasefire, the upper hand is giving to the resistance inside Gaza that is dictating the terms and rejecting any ceasefire in exchange of no commitment of the Israeli to pull out from Gaza, to withdraw the army, to allow the return of the refugees. That is a position of strength. It is not a position of people who have been under bombardment for the last 5.5 months and who, according to the Israeli wrong thinking, they are suffering defeat. On the contrary, it is the Israeli army that is screaming. It is the Israeli army that is demoralized. The Israeli defense ministers are saying we are paying a very heavy price, not the resistance. The resistance is working quietly, and we see the result on the ground by the failure of the Israeli army not only not to achieve and fail to achieve the objectives of defeating Hamas and release all the prisoners, but not capable of controlling any area that the army went into, right, in the north, and Khan Yunis.
Mr. Ahmad Mayed, the Yemeni army says it has carried out fresh attacks on U.S. and Israeli vessels in the Indian Ocean and is expanding the scope of its pro-Palestinian and retaliatory operations. Talk to us about the Yemeni response to the Gaza onslaught and the defiant message that the Yemenis have been sending to the U.S. and its allies.
The ally of the Palestinian people has clearly been the brothers of Yemen and there in the north, the brothers of Hezbollah. We have seen promises from the leadership of the resistance axis to ensure that there is an escalation, particularly during this holy month. And the Yemeni brothers have stepped forward and fulfilled their promise in this regard. What is very interesting is that ships had been routed around the Cape of Good Hope here in South Africa. And the South African port had been abandoned for a long time because of the excessive distance that they would have to travel, and the Suez Canal shortens this. However, the fact that the Yemenis have already targeted certain ships, I believe it's the USS Laboon and three other vessels that were heading towards the Cape of Good Hope, is an indication that the entire blockade will tighten around Israel. This will exacerbate the already critical economic and fragile situation within Israel. Israel is sitting with a huge problem right now. Their reservists had to be released back into civil life simply because the economy is suffering. They are extremely exhausted. They cannot continue with the fighting at the pace that they did at the very beginning. And that is why you see this limited incursions. That is why you see the bombing of individuals whilst they obtain aid. These are gutted tactics by the Israeli regime. The Yemenis, however, have shown a very principled position that despite the international pressure, despite the consistent, almost daily bombings by the US and the UK coalitions of Yemen, they continue to remain firm and fixed on their commitment to the Palestinian people. I believe we will see further capabilities of the resistance in Yemen. We have already seen new weapon systems being rolled out that have shocked the Americans, that have shocked the Israelis, and have shocked the United Kingdom. And I believe we will see entrances of other individuals and other actors within a very short space of time, especially considering the expansion of this particular operation and war now.
Elijah Magna, why aren't regional blocs or even Arab governments stepping up and taking matters into their own hands? Many officials have called on Muslim and Arab countries to openly express their opposition to the Israeli regime and sever ties with the Israelis. Why is that not happening?
Well, we have seen two countries like Qatar supporting the negotiation and Egypt really closing Rafah. That was a very important step not to accommodate the Israeli plan to create another Nakba, the Palestinian, and displaced 1.5 million Palestinians from Gaza. But on the other hand, we have seen Jordan and the Emirates doing a great job in facilitating the passage of fruit and vegetable to the Israelis through their land, shamelessly providing all the support that Israel needs while simultaneously going on the media and complaining about the victims and the murders of the Palestinians in Gaza. So you cannot be the second largest producer of fruit and vegetables to Israel, that is, i.e. Jordan, because the first is Turkey, and then complain about how the Israelis are starving the population, and then offering a land support. Basically, because the Arabs want to give up on the Palestinian cause, they don't want to hear it because it embarrasses them with all the normalization that they are in process or others they have already achieved. And this is something that they cannot face the people in the Middle East and around the world that are more powerful than the Middle Eastern countries in standing with a just cause, i.e. the Palestinian cause. And that is quite embarrassing when we see all the Arab countries who have the potentiality to put an end to the Israeli arrogance and killing and stop Israel, particularly those who have borders with Israel, and impose the break of the siege like the Yemen Ansarullah are admirably doing, and carrying the honor of the world population, imposing humanitarian law on the Israeli by preventing their shipment. But on the other hand, unfortunately, we see all the sacrifices of the Yemeni are wasted by countries, Arab countries, who are offering the land road to supply the Israelis with fruit and vegetable. So this contradiction that we see between the language used by the Islamic country and many Middle Eastern countries, and at the same time, they pretend to be more concerned when they're not lifting a finger, and they are they have no sensibility to the image of the children and the women begging in the street for food and killed in the street, cut in pieces by the murderer of the Israeli. Israel would have never dared to such an act had the Arabs been united.
Very well. We're going to have to leave it there. Journalist and political analyst Elijah Magna joining us from Brussels, and attorney, activist, and political analyst Zakir Ahmed Mayet from Johannesburg. Gentlemen, thank you for contributing to our program, and thanks for staying with us on Spotlight. Bye-bye.
We'll be right back.
from east to west. Throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
Economic boycott against the Zionist regime is not a new phenomenon. It hits the apartheid entity where it feels and hurts the most. It is one of the most significant weak spots of the Zionist regime occupying Palestine. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Crescent International wrote, as the low-intensity regional war and transformation take shape in West Asia, the fronts against apartheid Israel and its Western enablers are acquiring a multidimensional character. One of those multidimensional characteristics involves a grassroots economic boycott by consumers of Western and Israeli businesses. Economic boycott against the Zionist regime is not a new phenomenon. It hits the apartheid entity where it feels and hurts the most. It is one of the most significant weak spots of the Zionist regime occupying Palestine. While purely econometric reasons are certainly important, it is only one of the factors and not the factor. A significant number of Zionist colonizers in Palestine hold foreign citizenship. Figures vary from 10%, according to the Dual Citizenship Report, to 17%, according to Times of Israel report of 2016, to 22%, according to Israeli blogger Daniel Barenboim. There is a speculation that the actual figures may be as high as 35% or even 50% of Israelis holding dual citizenship. They will not stick around in a hostile environment, which will become even more difficult as economic, political, and military pressure continues to increase on the Zionist regime. When a better option is easily available, away from war and economic ruin, not all, but many people will opt for the easier option, leave. Both the current Zionist mass murder campaign in Palestine and the regional resistance to Israel are unprecedented in nature and totally out of proportions. This applies to the economic and boycott angle of resistance against the Zionist regime and its Western enablers. What makes this current limited impact a longer-term strategic challenge to Israel and brands facing the grassroots boycott is that this time, due to the scale of events in the region, more people have joined and it is clearly having some impact. The phenomenon of limited impact creates a vicious perception cycle, which then translates into concrete negative monetary impact. As some brands can no longer conceal that the grassroots boycott is having an impact, more ordinary consumers are motivated by the fact that their objection to genocide in Palestine is working. This results in more people joining the boycott since they feel empowered. This phenomena snowballs into a much bigger boycott movement. Those familiar with the politics of the so-called Muslim streets in West Asia and the Arab world know well that boycotting of brands closely associated with Western imperialist regimes has been around for decades. Yet in the past, it was almost never the case that the targeted corporations themselves would admit that they are being impacted. Another factor which is contributing to more impact on the boycott clear-cut front is the sophistication of the current campaign in terms of technological use and quality of production. For example, Libyan youth produced a video urging boycott of Pepsi has gone viral mainly due to its production quality. The mentioned factors, combined with a significant weakening of Western economies backing the Zionist genocide in Palestine, is on its way to have a lasting effect. Such impact will continue to gain traction even after the guns fall silent in Palestine. Nevertheless, boycott without a broader plan and effort to build alternatives to brands being boycotted is a limited blow to Israel and its enablers. While there are also some grassroots attempts to fill in this gap, like Palestine Cola, being produced in Sweden by two Palestinian brothers, the approach needs to be state-driven.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Thank you. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.